legislature hanging out with Moran County.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order, and I want to apologize to everyone that's here at 8:30. Unfortunately, for y'all, I had a 8:30 TV radio interview that I had to do back in district, and we didn't post it correctly today to start at 8:45. And for the record, that's probably what we're going to see every other Monday, for I can stay in touch with my constituents in Douglas County. With that, we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 233. And so I'll open a public hearing on 233. And Council, why don't you give us an overview while we're waiting.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 233 comes to you at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. This bill creates a statutory framework for victims to exercise their constitutional rights set forth in Section 42 and 43 of Article 1 of the Constitution. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is a product of a work group of a year and a half efforts of the Department of Justice, 9-month efforts of part of the legislature. Senator Bonamici participated in the process. Participants include the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the District Attorneys Association. A lot of effort on behalf of the Department of Justice, representative of victims, and the courts, parole and probation. It is truly a collaborative effort. You also have in front of you the -1 amendments. Probation had some concerns about some of the requirements on them. Judge Barron from Coos County suggested a change last week. I emailed it out to everyone. They seem compatible with the change, which should be on page 20. Legislative Council's office worked on the amendments all weekend long, and I submitted them at 4:30 on Friday afternoon, and they had them in our office at 7:30 this morning. So.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. So at this point, they're ready to move if we're wanting to go forward.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. The only other thing I want to do, just for housekeeping, we have two other bills that are scheduled for hearing today. We will hear both of them, but they're going to be out of the order that's currently listed on the agenda. Because of scheduling issues for one of our witnesses, Senate Bill 106 is going to move in front of 107. With that, I'm going to go ahead and call up the first panel for Senate Bill 233, Attorney General John Kroger, Steve Dole, and Doug Duhalde. Mr. Attorney General, thank you very much for being here today. Hope you had a good weekend. And we'll let you read off if you like, and then I guess Mr. Dole after that.
Well, I'd like to thank the chair and the members of the committee for holding this hearing. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 233.
And I'll be very brief. As you know, over the last 10 years we've seen...
Mr. Attorney General, I need you to just for the record say who you are.
You'll forgive a rookie mistake, Mr. Chairman. John Kroger, I'm the Attorney General of Oregon.
Thank you.
As the committee is aware, there's been a
real revolution in victims' rights over the last 10 years. In the past, victims of crime were often victimized twice, once by the actual crime and one by a process that didn't allow them to fully participate. The theory was always that prosecutors could speak not just for the state, but for victims as well. But in a number of critical parts of any criminal proceeding, the interest of the state and the interests of crime victims often diverge, particularly at bail and at sentencing. In Oregon, we've been nationwide leaders in providing victims with greater rights. But until the Constitution was amended in June 2008, victims did not have standing in the courts to enforce those rights. And so the promise that they would be able to participate fully in the criminal process was often denied. What Senate Bill 233 does is creates an orderly process for crime victims to participate in criminal cases, both by establishing a process by which they can be informed of the important parts of the case that they might want to participate in, to make sure that they are heard and to give them certain appellate rights so that if their rights are denied, they can have a chance to appeal that. It's the product of a lot of work by Hardy Myers and certainly by the various groups that were put together by both the Department of Justice and the legislature, and we strongly urge its passage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Dole.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 233, and we ask your support and your yes vote on this bill. As the Attorney General said, and I hate to say this, but actually the fight for victims' rights and the changes we've had goes back more than 10 years. It, ironically or coincidentally, this is the 25th anniversary this year of the first victims' rights statutory piece that was placed on the ballot in front of the Oregon voters in 1984. That failed. In 1986, Crime Victims United came back and placed another piece on the ballot, and the first statutory provisions were passed for crime victims that year. In 1992, we attempted to place a constitutional rights piece on the ballot. We failed. And in 1996, of course, Measure 40 was passed. It was found unconstitutional by the courts in 1998, and in 1999, through the good graces of this legislature, we put seven pieces on the ballot, four of which passed. As the Attorney General mentioned, the current piece you have in front of you, Senate Bill 233, is the result of Measures 51 and 52, which were overwhelmingly passed by the voters last June, and is a culmination of 2 years of work by various groups, including the Attorney General's office. I have to tell you, over the years, that despite the fact that we had constitutional rights for crime victims, as a leader of one of the crime victims groups in Oregon, I would take calls often in which crime victims would call me and say my right was violated. And unfortunately, I had to say to them, there's nothing we can do about that. That's all changed now with the passage of 51 and 52. And Senate Bill 233 merely sets up the framework for these constitutional amendments to work. I want to mention that the ODAA, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, is in support of this bill, as is Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and Parents of Murdered Children. I thank you very much for your time and encourage your yes vote on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Beloff.
Hey, my name is Doug Beloff. I'm a professor of law at Lewis and Clark College. I'm an expert both nationally and in the state on crime victims' rights. I'm very gratified about this bill. Oregon can once again claim it is a leader in the nation because this legislation sets forth the most comprehensive and thoughtful set of procedures implementing victims' rights in the country, should it indeed be passed. We're very grateful for the guidance of Bill Taylor, who worked very hard and thoughtfully on this bill to get it to its present place. The bill has the thoughts and ideas of many people from various perspectives in the system, including courts, prosecutors, defense counsel, crime victims, and others. So the legislation is important because what it does is it facilitates the mainstreaming of crime victims' rights into the American civil rights model. That is, a constitutional amendment in May made them enforceable, and this legislation explains to all the parties and the court system and to victims how those constitutional rights can be enforced. It is designed to make the process more efficient by actually providing guidance and a structure to implement enforcement of the rights, as well as to make those rights meaningful. So from my perspective as a national expert on crime victims' rights, this is a model piece of legislation, and I urge its enactment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for any of the panelists? Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming here today, and it's good to see our new Attorney General there. I think you'll learn pretty quickly. I have a feeling you'll be coming in front of this committee every now and then, but it's great to see you. As a practical matter, was it discussed in the task force how many cases you anticipate that will be affected by this bill?
We have had some preliminary discussions Senator, but it's very hard for us to predict exactly how much litigation it will generate. We don't think it will be a huge volume, but this is somewhat of a new direction for the state. The one thing I would say is that we feel confident that there will be less litigation if this bill is passed than there would be if the crime victims were left to the constitutional rights in the Constitution, but there was no statutory process to guide the exercise of those rights. Part of our goal here is to provide for both the courts and the parties a clear procedural roadmap for how those constitutional rights are to be protected and enforced. And absent that, I think you would see a larger volume of litigation and greater confusion in the courts. So though we don't have a concrete estimate about how many cases this will generate, I think we're very comfortable that it will reduce litigation overall compared to if it were not passed.
Can I have a quick follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. And also, do you have any projections, or was it discussed in the task force, and I don't know how involved you were with that, about how difficult or easy it would be to actually track victims, to notify them?
Senator, because I did not participate in those discussions, I think I might defer to Steve Dole or Doug Belouf.
Well, probably, you know, what this does is it ensures that procedures for notification will be implemented. The truth is that district attorneys have implemented procedures to notify victims, although it is true that some cases fall through the cracks. What both the constitutional rights provide and this provide is an incentive to reinvigorate notification procedures. And I know that the crime victim unit in the Attorney General's office was closely involved with Hardy Myers in both this legislation and the constitutional amendment has re-examined notification. In addition to the fact that Hardy Myers had a three-year project to ensure compliance with victims' rights. During that time, many state and local agencies came to the table and re-examined their notification procedures as well as any literature they provided to crime victims. So there has been a vigorous improvement in the last 5 years, aside from this legislation, on notification of victims, the information given to victims, and the methods that information can be obtained by victims. The web, for example, the phone, for example, as well as literature given out by police and prosecutors.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Professor Belouf anticipated my question. I wanted to get a sense of how much of a departure this is from existing practice, because, as you mentioned, many of the counties have procedures in place already. So are we talking about significant changes from existing practices, or is this something that's already being done in most of the state?
Right. I think if we could divide current practices into A, administrative practices, and B, legally required practices, I think the administrative practices were resolved in the compliance task force effort that went on during a period of about 3 years. And that was a cooperative effort between county agencies, state agencies, corrections, courts, and everyone else. So there was a great focus on how to make that better institutionally as an administrative matter. This bill does not actually change what the legal requirements are, particularly of prosecutors, for instance, or police. Those already exist in law. What this does is to provide a way of enforcing rights if they are in fact not complied with. So it's kind of a different lens that we're looking through, right? We're not looking through the how do you administratively provide notice lens. We're looking through the lens of what if you completely fail to provide notice. The Constitution provides you must, and what this does is provide, well, essentially criminal procedures for the courts and for the parties to figure out where you go from there. Importantly, it's designed to try to resolve all those issues quickly at the trial level. so that there aren't inefficiencies in its going up. To the extent it changes things, it would take what would be a completely undefined procedural territory where the courts would be reacting and trying to sort out how they would handle a complaint of a denial of rights, which would be very inefficient and time-consuming, into a system where everyone knows what the rules are and we know how to proceed. Would be kind of equivalent to trying to litigate civil cases without the rules of civil procedure, and suddenly you invent them, and now it's much easier to do.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Professor Baloof, since you were instrumental in putting 233 together, I just want to put some stuff on the record just to make sure that we've got that covered if we ever have anyone looking at this in the future. My understanding, Senate Bill 233 is really the statutory implementation of the House Joint Resolution 49 and 50.
That's correct.
And it's my understanding that what is required under those two constitutionally approved measures have been adopted within SB 233?
That's correct.
And the only other thing is, I just want to make sure it is on the record, when you look at both of those resolutions under 49 under 3D, and then on 50 under 5D, it does state that no matter what claim or right has been established under this section regarding victims' rights, it should not suspend the criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding in such a way that would violate an alleged defendant or youth offender's rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so basically what we have before us does in fact comply with that, and it is the intent of this legislation is to implement what has been brought forward under HJR 49 and HJR 50 as they were passed by the voters in May of 08.
That's correct. The purpose is to facilitate that.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any other questions based on that? Gentlemen, if there's not anything else, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I have two other people that are currently scheduled on the list who'd like to give testimony today, Troy Klossman and Julie McFairlong. Whoever would like to start off, Troy, you were listed first, so I'll give you first option. All right. Julie?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, which is a law firm of 21 attorneys representing juveniles in dependency and delinquency cases. We also have a SchoolWorks program and other advocacy programs on behalf of children. I am here today in opposition to Senate Bill 233 as it applies to juveniles. I do think that this bill would violate the constitutional rights of juvenile delinquent defendants in some fairly obvious ways. Our major concern is the delay that would be caused by the procedures in this bill, but we also have other concerns. For instance, this bill defines a juvenile delinquent as a criminal defendant, and that is completely contrary to the constitutional bases for a different, separate, and less due process-oriented juvenile court. So when you start defining a juvenile delinquent who under the statute is not convicted of a crime as a criminal defendant and you start to chip away at that, then you must also consider providing the due process protections of an adult criminal defendant, like a jury trial and bail. And those are things that don't exist in juvenile court because we do still have, perhaps only an illusion at this point, that we have a special solicitude for children, that children are in fact different, and that we are not going to treat them the same as adults. As I indicated, my biggest concern in this bill for its treatment of juveniles is the delay that it would cause. Children's lives go by quickly. There are very serious considerations about delays that, for instance, could result in them being excluded or expelled from school because of loss of time. So what would seem to be a fairly short period of time in an adult's life just simply is not in the life of a juvenile. I think also I have a very serious concern, and Attorney General Kroger alluded to the fact that the interests of the prosecutor and the interests of the victim are not always the same. Yet this bill continues to expand on the notion that the prosecutor will be the representative of the victim. And in my view, that's a conflict of interest that would never be tolerated in any other area of the practice of law. And it is very clear that there are conflicts between prosecutors and victims. And these procedures are for the victim to gain relief from those conflicts as well as other things that they might view as a violation of their rights as a victim. So I would encourage the committee to consider an alternative to continuing to place the prosecutor in what I view as an untenable role, and certainly a role that is not going to really bring satisfaction to victims who feel like they have been harmed in the system. Lastly, the proposed Attorney General's Task Force on Victims' Rights Enforcement does not include a juvenile defender, and I think that is a major oversight, as was the lack of juvenile defender participation in the committee that worked on this bill. I have nothing further, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
All right, we're going to go hear from Troy Klossman first, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Klossman.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Troy Klossman. I'm actually representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors today, or the local supervisory authority, as well as the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And basically, we'd just like to state that we recognize the importance of victims' rights and wholeheartedly support that, but also would like to indicate that as the bill was currently written under 233, that OACCD and OSSA were opposed to some of the language in that particular bill, and with the amendment 233-1 and a conversation with Legislative Counsel Taylor this morning, that if the amended language was accepted, that we would support the bill being written that way according to 233.1.
Just for clarification, with the dash one amendments, then whatever opposition that currently is held by those two organizations would go away because it would address those issues?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. Questions for either of the panelists. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. McFarland. You indicated your opposition here. Were you involved in the discussions over the last year, I think in the last session, in regards to the preparation of this measure? And the second question, has your organization challenged Measure 40 in court?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the very last of that.
The second half is if it's unconstitutional, did you challenge Measure 40 in court?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, we were not included in the group that worked on this bill. I don't know what the history of that is, but I am not aware of our participation in that. I do recall a challenge that we might very well have signed on to that, although certainly we were not a major challenger.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you,
right.
Mr. Chair.
And just for clarification, for Measure 40, that one was actually court's rule that single subject issue.
Right. And we did do that challenge.
Right. And so that's what broke out. And then we in the legislature referred out, as Mr. Dolcet stated, there were actually nine, I think, measures that came before the legislature. Seven of those nine were advanced to the populace for their consideration, and of those four, the seven actually passed. So do you know if there's been any challenges for the four that did pass in, would have been in 2000, if any of those have been challenged.
Chair Pruszynski, I would want to go and check that before I took a guess at that answer.
Council?
Chair, members of the committee, this bill is similar to a bill that was before the special session in 2008. That's House Bill 3633. The House Judiciary Committee had at least three hearings on the bill. Prior to that, for a year and a half, 2 years, the Attorney General's office had a work group on this. Anyone familiar with the Department of Justice and their process and procedure knows that they go out of their way to notify everyone that's possible, all the way from the Oregon State Bar, the Criminal Defense Bar, probation, parole officers. We continue that process after special session. We notified everyone that within the legal community that we were aware of had an interest. Juvenile Rights Project did not particularly participate, but other groups, including the Oregon State Bar, of which many of their members, the people who work for the Juvenile Rights Projects, are members, and also the Criminal Defense Bar were notified. So I would have to say that we went out of our way to duly notify everyone that we thought had an interest in the bill.
All right. Ms. McFarland, I'm going to redirect on your testimony. I think one of the very first things that you said was concern is how the youth offenders have been, quote-unquote, lumped into the definition of being convicted of crime. Is there specific areas in Senate Bill 233 where you want to address or focus us as to where you think that there's been that blending of the juvenile proceedings into some type of criminal proceeding?
Chair Pruszynski, my reference was to the inclusion in the definition of criminal defendant of juveniles, youth offenders. And I think it is a rather small step to go from saying that a person is a criminal defendant for purposes of this bill to what is prohibited by the juvenile code, which is to consider a juvenile delinquent to be convicted of a crime.
All right. So the issue that you're bringing forward is the definition of defendant, which is for purposes on page 2, lines 13 and 14. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Council?
So, Chair, members of the committee, and I think Senator Bonamici may remember this, we had lengthy discussions about definitions in this bill. It says defendant includes a person under the age of 18. Does not say criminal defendant. It is simply a way of being able to draft this bill so it would have a more coherent approach than to try to have to go through the bill and use term criminal defendant and then juvenile delinquent, et cetera, or juvenile offender, depending on the stage of the process. It's simply to try to make the bill more coherent.
All right, and that's the reason why, let's say, we've collapsed that into a single definition of a defendant, maybe even broader than what the context is, but it's limited for the purpose of implementing this particular bill.
Chair, members of the committee, that's my recollection, and I know there are people from the work group who may agree or disagree with that, but that's my recollection.
We'll give them an opportunity. Senator Bonamici, do you want to comment on this?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall specific discussions about this particular provision as it applies to juveniles, but I do note that in the bill, it does, in addition to not including the word criminal defendant, it does say a person under 18 years of age alleged to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court under ORS Chapter 419C. So it's further limiting that it is intended to apply to those particular defendants. So, again, I agree with Counsel Taylor that it seems to be a definitional purpose, but not a labeling of all juveniles as criminal defendants.
All right. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. That's all I had that were signed up on the registration for witnesses today. Is there anyone else that's in the room that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 233? Not seeing anyone coming forward, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233. Chair is going to hold this bill. We have the -1 amendments that that I expect will be offered, but since we do not have the revenue statement, or is it the fiscal?
Chair, members of the committee, we do not have the fiscal statement yet.
Thanks.
Can you get the notice?
as we wait.
Okay, and I'm just going to put on the record a request of Senator Bonamici. We did receive written testimony from John Stein, who's the Executive Secretary of the International Organization of Victim Assistance out of Newburgh, Oregon. That is part of the record. All right, if there's nothing else, I'm going to go ahead and call in to, I guess, yeah, for the record, what I need to do is say that Senate Bill 233 will be back before us on Thursday of this week with the intent of considering the Dash 1 amendments. We expect that the fiscal statement will be in by then, and we'll be able to take action at that time. Any other questions or discussions regarding Senate Bill 233? If not, we'll close this mini work session, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 106.
Senate Bill 106, it's a request of the Oregon Youth Authority, allows the Oregon Youth Authority to contract with federally recognized Indian tribes in Oregon to provide gang intervention services to the tribe.
All right, and we have three individuals who are here to testify. I have Bobby Mink, and Mr. Mink, you have someone with you who doesn't look like David, doesn't look like Michael. What I'm going to do is, Mr. Mink, I know that you have other engagement that you need to attend to, so why don't you go ahead and get started, and we'll see if there's any questions, and then let you go on to your other duties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bobby Mink. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I've been the interim director. I was technically on board from August on. I overlapped with the previous director. He left in October, so I've been the director since then. And because of my short time, with me is Robin Cole, who's a 30-year employee of the Oregon Youth Authority. So if you get to specific questions, she's going to have some history for you. This is really interesting. This is my first time to testify before a legislative committee in about 8 years, so it's I excuse anything I forget about protocol in advance.
You're doing great, and you did the best thing you could, and that's bring the certified smart people with you to field those questions.
And she's one of those. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is a simple bill, and it's a short bill, and basically what this bill does, Senate Bill 106, is give the Oregon Youth Authority the ability to contract with Indian tribes for gang intervention services. In talking with our legal counsel at the Department of Justice, right now the statutory framework for the Oregon Youth Authority doesn't permit us to do that. And so this is a bill to allow us to do it. It's really interesting. When I first came to the Oregon Youth Authority, right after I became interim director, one of the very first meetings I had was with the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, talking about this very issue, the inability to work with the Oregon Youth Authority like they work with other state departments. And one example is the Department of Human Services, where I worked for a long period of time. And at the Department of Human Resources, we have many relationships, contractual relationships with the tribes to provide services. And so the meeting with the Grand Ronde tribe was, they would hope that I would look to try to do some of the same things. Well, fortunately, the previous administration asked the governor to submit this bill to provide gang intervention services. So I'm in support of that. And what I'm asking today, Mr. Chair, is for us to broaden that, and I would like to amend this so that we can have the ability to contract with the tribes for different types of grant funding than we may receive from either the state legislature or the federal legislature. The amendment I'd like to do, though, would exclude any of the regular pass-through monies we have for counties for basic services, diversion, and the like. So this is a limited amendment. So that if we do get some grant funding in the future, like we have in the past, as an example, Robin tells me over the last few years, not only have we had some gang intervention service money from the federal government, we've also had some sex offender intervention money, and also some alcohol and drug intervention money. And those would be things that I would think that we could also contract with the tribes to do. So that's it.
All right. And Ms. Cole, did you have something else that you wanted to share before we take
only
questions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, only here to answer questions if I could be of help.
Oh, thank you. Are there any questions at this point? Bobby, I guess the only thing I want to make certain is on the amendment that you would like, is there already a request for that to be drafted?
We have permission from Mr. Taylor that we can take that to Lidge Council if the chair would allow that.
Yeah, I have no problem with that, but I do want to make certain, just like in the last bill, we received the amendment this morning. One of the reasons I didn't want to take that amendment up is I want to make certain everyone has an opportunity to kind of digest it.
Yeah.
So once the amendment's set up, then we'll make certain all the committee members have an opportunity to review it, and we may need to have some additional testimony.
Yes, that'll be fine.
Once we see the amendment.
That'd be great.
All right. Any other thoughts or comments?
Yes.
All right, thank you very much for coming forward. I think we have a couple more people who wanted to give testimony on this bill that are signed up. Michael Mason and David, is it Fullerton? Whoever would like to go first?
Chair Przanski, we drew straws, and I got the short straw. So, Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Michael Mason. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. The Confederated Tribes is here today to testify in favor of this bill, and from the draft amendment, at least, that we've seen, to testify also in favor of that. But sounds like that'll be taken up later. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs has worked with state agencies on the tribal state government-to-government relationship for many years before the passage of Senate Bill 770, the Government-to-Government Relationship Act that enshrined this concept of the tribal state relationship in Oregon law. The Legislative Assembly has on several occasions given positive practical effect to Senate Bill 770, including with Oregon Department of Transportation, Department of Human Services, and the State Library. The tribes welcome the Oregon Youth Authority's effort to enliven Senate Bill 770 with Senate Bill 106 and appreciate the effort to expand the relationship beyond just the gang-related funding. Though one reason that I'm here today is that last summer the reservation was racked by two gang-related murders. Very few people know about these. It's not something that the tribes want to speak of particularly, but in one of these, it was a very brutal crime against a young mother that left her infant orphaned. And so the gang problem has really struck Warm Springs in a terrible way, and it's very important that we do everything we can to work together with the state to combat this. So again, thank you for the opportunity to testify and appreciate your efforts on Senate Bill 106 and urge passage and consideration of the amendment as soon as you can.
Thank you. Mr. Fullerton.
Yes, good morning. My name is David Fullerton. I represent the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. Here to testify in support of Senate Bill 106 and in support of the amendments as read. As was stated, I think the gang issue in Indian Country is prevalent. We're facing the same things that everyone else is facing and need the tools to address that. I think this bill allows us to access those tools and truly recognizes the spirit of Senate Bill 770 in working with the state lead agencies in accessing that funding and those tools to address this issue. The tribes have the data to show that our programs are effective. Working with our children and families, I think we know best how to work with them through these interventions and programs. And we'd ask that the committee support this bill. We also had received short notice support from four other tribes in support of this bill passing. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of our panelists? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else today who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 106? Not seeing anyone coming up, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 106. It's my understanding that there will be amendment that will be drafted. Upon that amendment being drafted, we'll get it rescheduled for work session and possible adoption at that time. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 107. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 107 comes with the request of the Oregon Youth Authority. This bill joins the Oregon to the new Interstate Compact for the Supervision of Juvenile Offenders and Runaways, applies to juveniles and runaways traveling across state lines, makes Oregon part of the Interstate Commission that will manage and regulate the interstate supervision of juvenile offenders. This compact has already been adopted by 35 states, and one of the problems we face is that the old compact will go out of force in December of this year.
Okay, great, thank you. And Karen, I'm assuming is before us, and the other two gentlemen.
Good morning, Senator Przanski. My name is Karen Andel with the Oregon Youth Authority. Also with me, David Cook, who is the director of the Multnomah County Juvenile Justice Division, and Harry Gilmore with the Department of Human Services.
All right, whoever wants to lead off.
All right. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for having us here this morning. My name is Karen Andel. I'm Assistant Director for Field Operations for the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 107, which was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Youth Authority. OA has proposed this bill to ratify the new Interstate Compact, effectively then replacing the current Interstate Compact for juveniles, which has been in place since 1959. The purpose of the new compact is to enhance and provide guarantees of compliance as well as appropriate movement and treatment of youth, offenders, and runaways, which are important guarantees not present in the current compact. We view this as vital to providing for public safety and safety of victims and children who run from our state, both for those youth offenders who come to Oregon from other states, as well as in cases where Oregon wishes and approves the sending of youth offenders to other states to reside or to visit. The Youth Authority administers the Interstate Compact for Juveniles and oversees approximately 2,950 youth cases during a biennium. Affected are youth who have been adjudicated for misdemeanor and felony crimes, as well as oversight and return of runaways who leave our state that need to be returned to Oregon, and to return those runaways who come to Oregon and need to be returned to their home states. Rulemaking begins for the new compact in December of 2009. At that time, the current rules for the current compact will be considered null and void, and the rulemaking will begin. Oregon believes it's imperative to be a part of that rulemaking process and also to be able to provide for consistent movement of youth. Once December 09 comes here, the Youth Authority will have, or Oregon will have, no authority to seek movement of youth offenders to other states or to request they be supervised, nor will the Youth Authority be in a position to ask for compliance by other states who have ratified to seek permission and for us to supervise those youth here in our state. As well, we have the runaway issue where youth run from our state and will not have the authority to move those children back and forth to either be returned or to come to Oregon. At this point, the Oregon Youth Authority is working on amendments to Senate Bill 107, and there should be a copy of an overview. We've been working with the Department of Justice. These are friendly amendments that would actually help this compact be aligned in alignment with the adult interstate compact, and it does, I think, assist the bill in several ways. It clarifies the composition of the state council that would be required here in Oregon. It also establishes a defined fund from which compact expenditures could be made. It clarifies that the compact, the rules, and the bylaws under the compact are binding on the state of Oregon, except to the extent that they conflict with the Oregon Constitution. And it also clarifies the effective date of the new compact and the expiration of the old compact. Basically, the Youth Authority is very strongly encouraging the passage of this bill so that we can provide for public safety and ensure that, to the extent possible, that we do not have further victims. Thank you. I'm here to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from the other individuals, either Mr. Cook or Mr. Gilmore.
Cook.
My name is Harry Gilmore, and I work for the Department of Human Services, Chair Przanski, and members of the committee. And Department of Human Services is in support of this bill, and I'd like to specifically comment on some specific ways that it impacts the children served by Department of Human Services in the Children, Adults, and Families Division. When children who are in the care and custody of DHS run away to another state and there's a need to have them returned, we rely on the provisions in the Interstate Compact for Juveniles to effectuate their return. Children who run away have certain rights and protections. They can protest their return to the state that they ran from. The Juvenile Compact ensures that those rights are acknowledged by the state where they are picked up, and it also ensures that there is a safe and efficient and legal way to return children if and when they're picked up in another state. The current Juvenile Compact that's in place today serves this function. It has regulations specifically for the return of runaways, not just children in dependency care, but any child that runs to another state. But when it comes to foster children, we frequently partner with the Oregon Youth Authority for the return of those children, and sometimes there are specific safety concerns, and the Juvenile Compact operationally has ways to ensure the safe return, and if there's supervision needed or escorts, we rely on the Juvenile Compact process to ensure that we can access those resources in another state. Because we're in a situation now where 35 states have ratified the new compact, and there's a time frame within which the old compact will remain in effect, but once that time is up, as Karen mentioned, we'll be in a situation where we don't have an agreement with other states, not only for the supervision of juvenile delinquents, but also for the return of non-delinquent runaways, which is the primary way that it impacts Department of Human Services. So we support the passage of this bill for that reason, and also because it's often the case that children who are in dependency care are also involved with the juvenile justice system, and they may have may be on parole or probation. And when children in dependency care go to live in another state with relatives or to be reunified with a parent in another state, the Juvenile Compact ensures that their supervision by a parole and probation officer in that state continues. And so that's another function that we see as critical for our kids who are in dependency care if they are in that situation where they're being supervised and they have conditions of their parole and probation. The Juvenile Compact ensures that those continue if and when they go to live with a relative in another state. And that concludes my comments.
Thank you. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is David Cook. I'm with the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm also president of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. And I'm speaking on behalf of OJDDA to urge your support of Senate Bill 107. County juvenile departments, in partnership with the Youth Authority, send adjudicated youth to other states for supervision when circumstances warrant, and provide supervision of youth transferred from other states when appropriate. Uniform standards and requirements are important, as is updating of the 50-year-old compact. Since the compact has been ratified nationally already, participation in the rulemaking process is critical to its implementation. This makes vital Oregon's ratification of the compact, so we have a seat at the table to ensure needs of youth and families are met, as well as public safety needs of communities. Given our geographic location immediately across the river from Vancouver, Washington, and Clark County, I can tell you that having a compact in place and agreements in place that allow us to, with an understanding of what the expectations are, transfer youth between Multnomah County and Clark County is very helpful. And I know my colleagues in the Juvenile Department Directors Association who border Idaho, those who border Washington, and those who border California and Nevada feel the same. Not that those states are our only trading partners, if you will, But any time a youth needs to come in from another state, or we need to send a youth to another state because their family happens to live there, having the compact in place, and especially an updated compact that very clearly specifies what the requirements are and agreements, is vitally important. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Actually, two quick questions. One, one of the purposes of the amendment is to establish a defined fund from which compact expenses could be paid. Where are the expenses currently being paid from on the current contract?
The expenses are currently being paid out of the agency's budget, the Oregon Youth Authority budget, and not a separate fund.
Not be appropriate to continue to do it that way?
Senator Whitson, Chair Brzezinski, my understanding, and I believe Department of Justice Legal Counsel is here in case we have more technical questions, need for answers, is that this would confine the expandability of the funding outside of this fund that would potentially impact the general fund of the agency.
I don't believe I understood that answer, but...
All right. Is there anyone here from DOJ that might be able to give some clarity, please? Mr. Gilmore. Thank you. If you were to state your name for the record.
My name is Susan Cancellier. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also OAA's contact counsel and have been for 8 or 9 years now. Sandra Przonski and members of the committee, what this defined fund does is, excuse me, the fees for the compact are set by a committee that's comprised of a number of individuals, one from each state. If we keep the money in a defined fund, that will limit the amount of expenditures that Oregon needs to pay based on what this defined committee can set. This provision is already in the adult compact. It's working with the adult compact, and we're trying to streamline the juvenile compact so that we can draw on the experiences that we've already had with the adult compact.
Thank you. The other question, Chair Brzezinski, it's my understanding that in the current contract, a state can withdraw by passing a statute that withdraws the state from the compact. Will your amendment clarify that continues to be the case in this new compact?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, the current compact says in it without the amendment that the way that the new compact says that the way to get out of it is to pass a statute repealing it. That's already in there. What this amendment would do is establish that the new compact would be in effect to supervise Oregon's dealings with the 35 states that have already enacted the new compact, but Oregon also needs a method of dealing with the 15 states or a few more, because state is defined as Guam and Northern Marianas Islands, that have not adopted the new compact. And part of these amendments would keep the old compact in place to establish a process for Oregon's dealings with the states that have not yet adopted the new compact.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for putting that on the record, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the reasons for this fund, and there's a similar fund in the adult compact, is to avoid constitutional issues relating to the legislature constitutionally not being able to delegate expenditures to another group. So we can't delegate. In other words, the body in Lexington, Kentucky could assess monies. If we haven't appropriated those, we can't pay them. So this creates a fund similar to what we have in the Department of Corrections that keeps us constitutionally sound.
Mr. Counsel, where does that fund come from? What is the source of that fund in the other?
Chair, members of the committee, that's a fund that the legislature would fund through the agency.
The general fund?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, it would be from the general fund.
Thank you.
All right. I just want to put on the record, based on what I've heard, is why the amendment's necessary. Looking at the proposed amendment sheet for Senate Bill 107, under timing, under the current measure, it talks about that the new compact will only come effective upon it being ratified by all 50 states. And because of that, that's one reason we need to maintain a second procedure to deal with those states or territories that have not adopted it, which aren't within those 35. Is that correct?
Chair Brzozinski, as the current measure is drafted, the new compact will only become effective when, as it's phrased here, all 50 states have ratified it, although there are 56 entities. And the compact, without this timing provision in the current measure, is at the very end. It's not part of the actual compact language that has been ratified by all the other states. The compact language that's been ratified by the other states says it becomes effective when 35 states have enacted it. And so it's already effective as to those states. We want it to be effective for Oregon the minute Oregon steps into this, because it supersedes inconsistent state laws. And so we need to have it in place as a statute being operative right away, so that it can supersede the inconsistent state laws. We're a full party to this contract from the get-go, instead of only after all 50 states have ratified it.
Okay, I'm glad that you're putting this on the record. And the other part on that is that we do have an emergency clause for the reason that we want this and need this to be in place sooner than later.
That's correct, sir.
All right, any other questions? Thank you very much. Oh, sorry, Senator Brooklyn.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll have a question when the amendment comes out. I voted against the last version of this for the same reason counsel just explained.
Okay. So at this point, thank you very much.
You may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have answered my question, but I did see the inconsistent language in Article 10 about the effective date. So is the plan to just delete the Section 2 language in the amendment? Because it's inconsistent.
Sir Brzozinski, members of the committee, we're working with legislative counsel now to determine the best way to correct this problem. One thing that we have talked about is possibly keeping the whole old compact in place while having the new compact in place, but changing that tagline language in the end of Section 2, not getting rid of it entirely, but changing it to provide, if I can look at what we're talking about, keeping the old compact in effect, having the new compact be just operative right away, and it's already going to be effective because of the emergency clause. So we may just delete subsection 1 and 2. I'm just not sure at this point. We're working with
legislators
to look at that.
Okay, any other questions for this panel? Council?
Chair, members of the committee, the council, you mentioned all 50 states, but I'm looking at page 17. This is a compact become effective and binding upon legislators and act of the compact of law and by no fewer than 35 of the states.
Chair,
I'm sorry.
The compact is effective by its terms, when 35 states have adopted it. The Section 2 that was added on that mentions all 50 states is not part of the compact language that's been passed in the other states.
So, to me, the most important part, because when we were looking at this previously, we were trying to make certain that we were at a position of being, a player at the table. My understanding from what I've heard today, it's not too late to be a player at the table, so long as we get this in place sooner than later. All right, any other questions? All right, thank you very much for coming forward. Mr. Dole, Steve, and was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 107?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I come to you today in support of Senate Bill 107. I also come to you as one of the longest-serving members of the Oregon Youth Authority Advisory Committee. I'm not representing their views here, but I wanted to make clear that I am a member of that committee and have been very involved with the Youth Authority since its inception in 1995 through Senate Bill 1. Actually, Ms. Andahl stated my case for us. Our goal in Oregon has always been to have fewer victims, and if we have people who have committed crimes, or in the case of juveniles, been adjudicated of crimes that would be felonies if committed by an adult, if these people are not under supervision, it makes us all more vulnerable to crime. And of course, I don't think any of us want that, and so this bill provides for these people to be supervised and it provides for us to know who these people are when they come into our state. Also, like any Oregon citizen, we are very concerned about runaways, and we want to know about runaways. We want to know that we can bring our runaways from other states back to Oregon, because these children are also very vulnerable to become victims of crime, and as I know that you all realize, we have a tremendous problem in today's world with some of these kids being forced into the slave trade, and it happens a lot with runaways. So we support the bill and ask you to vote yes.
Great. Thank you
very much.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Since there's no one else that wanted to give testimony, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 107. Understand that there's an amendment that's going to be worked on that, and expect that it will be back before us once the amendment has an opportunity to be drafted. Council, is there anything else that we need to do today?
Chair, members of the committee, nothing else.
And since we have a floor session starting at 10, we're going to adjourn now, and thank you for participating in today's hearings.